This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Summer of My German Soldier by Betty Green. Narrated by Dale Dickey.
Chapter 1. When I saw the crowd gathering at the train station, I worried what President Roosevelt would think. I just hope he doesn't get the idea that Jenkinsville, Arkansas can't be trusted with a military secret because, the truth of the matter is, we're as patriotic as anybody. In front of the station house, 5 or 6 Boy Scouts in full uniform circled their leader, Jimmy Wells, who was wearing the same expression Dane Clark wore as the Marine Sergeant in infamy at Pearl Harbor. "This is the situation, guys," Jimmy said. "The sheriff told me it's the Army's job to get the Nazis off the train and into the prison camp, but I figure they'll be mighty glad to have us scouts on hand. And if any of those rats try to make a getaway..." He slapped the leather-encased scout axe strapped to his waist. "We know what to do." I looked around for a friendly group to join. Mary Wren was holding on to the arm of Reverend Ben's wife as though that was going to provide her with the Lord's own protection. There are plenty of jokes going around about our town's telephone operator. People say Mary is so generous that she'll give you the gossip right off her tongue. Then I saw old Chester, the colored porter from my father's store, closing his eyes against the brilliant June sun. I walked over. "Hey, Chester, don't you think this is the most exciting thing that has ever happened to our town?" His eyes jerked open. "I'm going back to the stockroom right now, Miss Patty. Ain't been gone more than 2, maybe 3 minutes." "Well, don't go on account of me, Chester. I won't tell my father, honest." Chester smiled wide enough to show his gold tooth. "I've never in my whole life seen a German. I mean, in person. Have you?"
"I've seen some foreigners once, but they was fortune-telling gypsies."
I looked over to where Sheriff Caldwell, Mr. George C. Hankins, the president of the Jenkinsville Rotary Club, and Mr. Quentin Blakely, editor of the Rice County Gazette, were standing on the gray-white gravel. "I wonder what the sheriff is saying about all this," I said, heading toward them. Mr. Blakey's head was pitched back to look into the sun and leather face of the sheriff.
"I said, Captain, I know you're only doing your job as a public information officer, but I'll never understand why I'm not supposed to write about what everybody here already knows about." "That's telling him, Quint," said the sheriff, looking amused. "More to it than that," said Mr. Blakey. "Captain wouldn't tell me how many POW camps there are or where they're located, but after a while he forgot about security. Told me that up in Boston they got a bunch of Italian prisoners who do nothing but clean up after the elephants in Franklin Park."
Sheriff Caldwell leaned his big head back and laughed the laugh of the healthy.
"Captain wasn't talking security. He was talking crap."
From down the tracks, a whistle. Jimmy Wells ran over to one of the rails, dropped to his knees, and pressed his ear against it. His features were molded into Dane Clark's "odds are against us, but we can do it" expression as he announced, "She's a-comin'!" All talking stopped, and the small clusters of people began merging into one single mass. Even Chester, the only Negro, was now standing in arm-touching contact with whites. Then, amid hissing, steamy clouds of white, the train braked, screeched, and finally came to a halt. From the crowd, a woman's voice, it may have been Reverend Ben's wife, asked,
"Well, where are they?"
Jimmy Wells pointed to the last passenger car.
"There!"
Everyone hurried toward the end of the train in time to see 2 GIs, with their sidearms still strapped in their holsters, step quickly from the car. Then came the Germans. The crowd moved back slightly, leaving a 1-person-wide path between themselves and the train. The prisoners were unhandcuffed, unchained young men carrying regulation army duffel bags. They wore fresh blue denim pants and matching shirts, and if it hadn't been for the black POW stenciled across their shirt backs, you could easily have mistaken them for an ordinary crew from the Arkansas Public Works Department sent out to repair a stretch of highway. I tried to read their faces for brutality, terror, humiliation, something. But the only thing I sensed was a kind of relief at finally having arrived at their destination. "Nazis!" a woman's voice shouted, and this time I knew for sure that it was Mrs. Ben. A blonde prisoner who was stepping off the train at that moment stopped short, then smiled and waved. It was as though he believed, or wanted to believe, that Mrs. Ben's call was nothing more than a friendly American greeting. I raised my hand, but before I completed a full wave, Mary Wren pressed it down, shaking her head. "I'm sorry, but I didn't think it would be polite. I guess I just forgot," I said, wondering if I was going to be served up as the main course for Mary Wren's gossip of the day. The last two prisoners stepped off the train. There were 15 or 16, maybe 20 in all. After them came two more American guards, one a sergeant. As the procession walked down the gravel slope to the waiting army truck, Jimmy Wells tapped on the sleeve of the American sergeant. "You mean this is all the Jerry's we're gonna get?"
"Don't worry, son," said the sergeant. "We're gonna keep you folks well supplied. Most of them have already been transported here by a truck caravan."
The prisoners and the GIs climbed aboard the canvas-covered vehicle. At the highway, it made a right turn and, shifting gears noisily, disappeared from sight. And so I had seen it, all there was to see. Yet I felt a nagging disappointment as though something were missing. In the movies, war criminals being hustled off to prison would be dramatic. Their ravaged faces would tell a story of defeat, disgrace, and downfall. But in real life, it didn't seem all that important. Not really a big deal. My stomach growled, reminding me that it must be nearing lunchtime. I followed the railroad embankment toward home, walking sometimes between the tracks and sometimes only on one track, balancing like a tightrope walker. I passed everybody's backyard. The Rhodeses, the Reeveses, the Bens, their laundry blowing on the line. The Reverend wears striped boxer-style shorts, and the Mrs. has very heavy bosoms. Her bras look like a D-cup to me. Parallel to our Victory Garden, I ran down the embankment past the lettuce, sweet corn, and tomatoes. The government says that until victory is won, everybody with a bit of land should grow their own food. Now, I know my father's patriotic, all right, but he's not doing exactly what the government asked us to do. A colored man, Grover, is the one who did the planting. I could see Ruth on the back porch, squeezing the clothes through the wringer. She is the color of hot chocolate before the marshmallow bleeds in. Sometimes I hear my mother telling her to lose weight. "It's not healthy to be fat." But she isn't actually fat. It's just that she has to wear large sizes. I mean, it wouldn't be Ruth if she were like my mother. And another thing, a little extra weight keeps a person warm inside. "Hey, Ruth!" She looked up from the wash. "Ruth, you know where I was? With the Germans going to the prison camp." She gave me her, "Have you been up to some devilment?" look. "I didn't do a single thing wrong," I said, wondering if my wave would count against me. I decided that it wouldn't. "This is still my week to be good and sweet. I haven't forgotten." Her face opened wide enough to catch the sunshine. "I'm mighty pleased to hear it. 'Cause before this week is through, your mama and daddy gonna recognize your natural sweetness and give you some back. And then you was gonna return even more, and..." "Maybe so," I interrupted her, and she went back to putting bed sheets through the wringer, understanding that I didn't want to talk about them anymore. There was the sergeant guarding the prisoners. You should have seen his medals. "I'm going to pray for Robert tonight, that he comes home with lots of medals, more than Jimmy Wells."
Jimmy Wells?
Ruth repeated the name as though she hadn't heard right.
Jimmy Wells ain't no soldier.
No, but he must have about every medal that the Boy Scouts know how to give.
Well, I don't care nothing about no wars and no medals. I just cares about my boy coming back safe.
I wanted to tell her that she had to care, how important it was for us to win this war, put an end to Nazism forever. But I could see that Ruth's heart was too troubled to enter into that kind of discussion. So I just said again I'd remember Robert in my prayers. A slow smile spread across her face, and I found myself smiling too. See, I congratulated myself, I don't always do everything wrong.
Go bring Sharon in from the sand pile, said Ruth. I'll fix us up some good old weenies and beans for lunch. Oh, I don't think I want any. Don't you go telling me what you don't be wantin', Miss Skin and Bones.
Am not. As a matter of fact, if you haven't noticed, I'm really quite formidable. I exposed teeth, squinted eyes, and fashioned claws out of my hands. Terribly and ferociously formidable.
That today's word? Asked Ruth.
Yes. Isn't it grand? It means exciting fear or dread. You like it?
I likes it right well, said Ruth thoughtfully. But I think one of my best favorites is one of them from last month. 'Cause one night after I got home and fixed up some supper for Claude and me and cleaned up my kitchen, I got to noticing my shelf paper was getting a mite yellow. So I says I better take care of it right now. Claude says leave it for another time 'cause it's pretty near to 7 o'clock and I bees needing my rest. And I says, Claude, you is right. But trouble is, you done married a fastidious wife. A real fastidious wife.
My sister was sitting straight up in the sand pile, shoveling sand over her legs. Sharon's not yet 6, exactly 5 years and 10 months. But whatever she does seems to have, at least to her, a kind of purpose. Hey, Sharon, I called. Where are your legs? She giggled like she knew something I didn't. Under the sand, silly. Are you absolutely sure? 'Cause once I had a friend named John Paul Jones, and John Paul put both legs under a lot of sand, and when he went to pull them out, no legs. All those hungry little sand bugs had eaten him right off. Sharon lifted her legs straight into the air. She seemed enormously pleased. Well, I've still got mine. See? In the center of the square breakfast room table, a bunch of backyard roses lounged in a flowered glass that had once held pimento cheese. Ruth carried in steaming plates of weenies and beans and some cut-up tomatoes, lettuce, and radishes from our victory garden. I found my appetite. Ruth gave Sharon a nod.
Is your time to be asking the Lord's blessing?
Immediately, without thinking, I said my own silent prayer. Please, dear God, don't let my father come in now. Amen. Sharon clasped her hands tight. We sure do thank you, dear Lord, for all the food we're going to eat up. Amen.
Amen, Lord, echoed Ruth.
I heard myself sigh. I think maybe I worried too much. After all, it's just plumb silly to think of him walking in on us right in the middle of our prayers. But what could happen is that Sharon might just mention it.
Christian prayers in my house?
The nerve at his temple would pulsate. Shouts of,
God damn you,
directed at me and maybe at Ruth. It's not that he's against praying or anything. Before the gasoline rationing, I used to go to Jewish Sunday school at the Beth Zion Synagogue in Memphis, so I know that Jews pray, too. My father asked those people down at the ration board for some extra stamps, but Mr. Raymond Hubbard said that he thought 80 miles round trip was a long ways to go praying, and he couldn't in good conscience consider it a priority item.
I made up some jello for you, said Ruth, eyeing my empty plate. No thanks, I'm all filled up. I made it just the way you like it. Her voice had softened. It's got bananas and nuts and cut up bits of marshmallows. I'll have a little. Did you really and truly make it especially for me? Only this morning I asked myself, what would Patty specially like for dessert? Then I tells myself the answer, and now you have your answer, too.
Ruth leaned back her head to let out a chuckle that was a full octave and a half down from middle C. My sister took up the laugh, and her top-of-the-octave laugh struck me funny, and then everything was. That's the way it is with Ruth, Sharon, and me. It isn't that our jokes are all that great. It's like Ruth says, we keep our jubilee in easy reach. Why can't it be that way with my mother and father? You show them your natural sweetness, Ruth reminds me, 'cause aunts ain't the only thing the sweetness attracts. I looked out the window at the summer green and wished for winter white. An Alaskan blizzard with wild winds hurling ice darts onto head-high drifts. For 4 days and 4 nights, the two of them have been isolated in the store. The power's down, the oil pipes have burst, and there's no food and no water. Ruth pleads with me not to try to reach them. You ain't gonna save them. You was only gonna kill yourself dead. Fill the thermos with hot soup, I tell her. 7 times I think I can't go on. The drift's too high, my feet and face beyond any feeling. But I do go on, and on, and finally I make it. I feed them soup and tuna fish sandwiches, and when they regain their strength, they tell me how much they love me, how much they have always loved me.
What you expecting to see out that window? Asked Ruth. The second coming of the Lord.
Never would I want her to suspect me of dreaming of a miracle. I was just thinking that I might take a walk down to the store, see what's cooking. She didn't look exactly thrilled by my idea. Isn't it you who's always reminding me to be sweet? Now what could be more thoughtful than bringing them up to the minute war news? They would like that, too. Doesn't my father listen to the 5-minute news with his neck jutting out towards the radio? And when H.V. Kaltenborn comes on, I swear if his nose isn't just about touching the cloth-covered speaker. Ruth dropped her head into the U between her thumb and her first finger.
I expect you spent the morning advising President Roosevelt on where to send his armies. That way you got your up-to-the-second war news.
If you don't think 100 ferocious Nazi prisoners arriving at the Jenkinsville Depot is war news, then I don't know what is. On Ruth's face was the dawning of a smile.
Got some sweetness to go with your up-to-the-second news.
I stood up. Maybe you ought to spend a little time telling my father and mother to serve some sweetness to me.
Reckon they listen?
Guess not. Ruth nodded her agreement.
Could you tell this old lady why you was always talking about your father when all the other young girls be talking about their daddies?
Well, daddies act one way and fathers act another. And anyway, I don't happen to be a young girl. I've been a teenager already for 2 years. She laughed.
Oh, honey babe, how can you be a teenager when you was only 12?
'Cause I've been one since I was 10. Not many people know this, Ruth, but teenage actually starts when you get 2 numbers to your age. See? I could tell that it hadn't convinced her. Don't you see? 10 is in reality 10-teen. Now, people don't generally go around calling it Tintin 'cause it sounds too much like the chewing gum, but that's the only reason. The smile that Ruth had been holding in suddenly broke through.
Honey, You just all the time go round making up rules to suit yourself. I got myself 2 big numbers to my age, and I sure ain't no teenager.
Well, I can explain that. When you have 2 numbers to your age, you're either teenage or after teenage, and you just happen to be after teenage, understand?
I think I'm beginning to see the light, and I do appreciate the kind explanation, little Miss Genius.
Make fun of me and I'll stop talking to you.
But can't good friends kid each other a little? Make each other smile.
I guess so. I gotta go to the store now.
Hold up a pretty minute, Patty. I want you to do me a mighty big favor that only you can do.
I tried to hide my pleasure that somebody needed a favor only I could do.
I want you to take off them faded old shorts and put on one of them nice pretty dresses of yours.
Sounds of my mother. For God's sake, why do I have to get all dressed up to go to the store? I'm coming right back.
Pride, Patty Babe. You gotta have pride.
Pride. Maybe that's it, what Ruth has. What makes her different. Keeps her from looking down at her shoes when talking with white people. Then it is all a lie what they say about her. Ruth isn't one bit uppity, merely prideful. Is that why you wear a Sunday dress to walk back and forth to work?
That's right, she said, looking pleased that I'd caught on so quickly. It's the pride. It's me shouting out to the world that one of God's creatures is walking on by. Do you think God would like it if we went and used a good book for a doorstop?
I shook my head no.
Well, now, you think he be liking it one bit better if one of his creatures be going round in dirty, worn-out clothes? You understand that, Patty?
I guess so. As I crossed Main Street, the heels of my sandals made slight half-moon impressions in the hot asphalt pavement, and I remembered what I'd heard said about heat at noon. Hot by noon, Hades by afternoon. It was one reason why almost nobody was about. But then the farm folks never come in unless it's Saturday, and the town ladies were home fixing a noonday meal for their families. My father says most weekdays you can shoot a cannon down Main Street and not hit a single living soul. Truth of the matter is, you'd probably need 2 cannons, 'cause the business section of Jenkinsville is T-shaped. Main Street running up and down, and Front Street running crossways. Most of the really important things, like our store, the Rice County National Bank, the post office, the picture show, the Save More Market, and the Victory Cafe are on Main. I passed by the Victory and read the sign painted in neat red lettering at the bottom of the plate glass window. Plate lunch, 25 cents, meat and 3 veg. The smell of fried ham had taken command of the air, so it was impossible to know exactly which 3 vegetables the Victory was serving. And there, stuck between the Victory Cafe and the Save More Market, was our store, best in town. I liked the sign. It's been freshly painted, big, bold black letters with a dash of red for emphasis. Bergen's Department Store. Quality goods for the whole family. Shoes, clothing, hardware, and variety. Standing at the piece goods counter with my father was a salesman, probably from Memphis or Little Rock, who was removing samples of men's dress shoes from a fitted black case. My father took a package of Toms from his freshly pressed suit coat, and as he popped one into his mouth, he nodded at the salesman.
Give me the usual run of sizes in the brogue, black only.
I wondered if I had time to give my father the news of the prisoners. I mean, if I talked fast. Better to test the water first. Hello? I said, taking a step forward. He dropped the Toms back into his pocket.
What are you doing here?
The salesman smiled at my father.
This your daughter, Harry?
My father's head moved slightly. The salesman gave me a full smile.
Well, well, what's your name, sweetheart?
Patricia Ann Bergen, sir.
Well, that's a pretty name for a pretty girl. Here, I have something for you.
He pulled out a package of Juicy Fruit gum. The wrapper showed the soil of having lived in his pockets for a while. Well, thank you anyway, but you see, I have this cavity, I lied.
Oh, that's all right, he said as though he hadn't heard me. You don't have to chew it now. You take it home.
I took the gum, thanking him as I backed away. I eased my disappointment by telling myself how smart I was to save my story for a more appropriate time. I looked around for my mother. She was sitting on one of the three cushioned chairs in the shoe department with Gussie Fields, who had been clerking here since even before her husband died. Hello, I said, remembering to smile. My mother said, Hello. And Mrs. Field said something about how pretty my dress was.
She's only wearing that dress because Ruth told her to, my mother said.
Ruth did not tell me to wear this dress, I said, hating the idea of being anybody's robot, even Ruth's.
What's Ruth doing? She asked.
Washing the clothes. I anticipated the next question, so I just supplied the answer.
Sharon is playing in the sandpile. Did Ruth give you both lunch?
Yes, ma'am. Mrs. Fields smiled her adult-to-child smile.
How are you enjoying your school vacation? As much as my niece, Donna Ann.
I wondered how I could honestly answer the question. First, I'd have to decide how much I was enjoying the summer. Not all that much. Then find out exactly how much Donna Ann Rhodes was enjoying it before trying to make an accurate comparison. Mrs. Fields' smile began to fade. Maybe she just wanted me to say something pleasant. Yes, ma'am, I answered.
When I was a girl, said my mother, turning toward Mrs. Fields, I used to drive my mother crazy with my clothes. If my dress wasn't new or if it had the slightest wrinkle in it, I'd cry and throw myself across my bed. You were just particular how you looked, said Mrs. Fields. I wish Patricia would be more particular, Mother said with sudden force. Would you just look at that hair?
I don't have a comb, I answered. Reaching into the side pocket of her dress, she produced a small red one.
Here, go look in the mirror and do a good job. You know, Gussie, you'd expect two sisters to be something alike, but Patricia doesn't care how she looks while Sharon is just like me.
Didn't Mother know I was still standing here? Couldn't she, at the very least, do me the courtesy of talking behind my back? I walked over to the three-way mirror in the dress department, but Mother's voice followed.
Why, before we take the girls to Memphis, Sharon has to try on a dozen dresses. And that one? Puts on the first thing her hand touches. She just doesn't care.
I took in my reflection. Oh, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the homeliest of them all?
You wait till she gets a boyfriend, Mrs. Fields was saying. She'll spend all the time fixing herself up. I wish I was sure of that. Some children just seem to be born with things others aren't. Now, take Sharon. She was never a moment's trouble.
If there were no mirrors or mothers, I probably never would know how ugly I am. But it was all there, plain as my reflection in the glass. Skinny bones, skinny face, feet too big and nose too long. In the mirror I could also see my mother's profile, a high, cool forehead and a slender nose that stopped where a nice nose ought to, a lot like Sharon's. And there were the lofty cheekbones that gave Mother's face form, symmetry, and on occasion great beauty. Sometimes I think God lavished so much beauty on her outsides that when he got around to her insides, there just wasn't much of anything left over.
When I returned the comb, my mother pulled a stray hair from its teeth before sliding it back into her pocket. "Wonder if Ellie Mae would have time for me," she said. Walking to the wall phone, she fluffed her hair into place as she gave the crank a couple of turns. "Mary, please ring up my Lady Beauty Parlor in Wind City." "No, I don't have the number," she said, resting her arm on the Rice County telephone directory. "Mother, did you hear about the POWs?" I asked. "A bunch of them just came in by train." "I don't know why they don't keep them over in Europe where they belong. It's dangerous having those criminals a mile from town." Her head shifted back to the speaker. "Hello, is this Ellie Mae? Do you know who this is?" "Well, Ellie Mae, I can be in Wind City in about 15 minutes. You think you could take me right away? Just a wash and set and one of your nice color rinses." "Oh, fine. See you in a few minutes." Actually, and I've told her this, her hair looks its very best just before she goes to the beauty parlor. By the time they finish with her, it's tight and unreal, like the hair on a department store mannequin. I watched her tear off a strip of adding machine tape and write $5 Pearl before exchanging her scribbled note for a fresh $5 bill. As my mother carefully applied her makeup in front of the three-way mirror, Mrs. Burton Benn came into the store looking as though she was on an important mission. A step away from my mother, she halted. "Mrs. Bergen," she said in the same tone that she must use when calling her Sunday school class together, "I have something to say." My mother smiled. "What can I do for you today, Mrs. Benn?" "It's about your nigra," said Mrs. Benn. "Ruth?" answered my mother as though she weren't completely sure of the name. "Yes, Ruth. After supper last night, the Reverend told me that I ought to leave the dishes and get right over to the Save More Market, take advantage of the markdown hamburg." "Well," she said, making the word sound important, "your Ruth, that uppity nigra, sees me making a beeline for the meat counter, and she practically breaks out in a run to get there first. She tells Jean, 'Give me the rest of that hamburg.'" Mrs. Benn's voice sounded like a white woman trying to imitate a colored one. "Now you just tell me, what's a darky gonna do with 2 pounds of hamburg? All she wanted was to keep me from getting any, and that's the truth." "Oh," said my mother, sounding genuinely grieved, "she's probably eaten it by now." "I don't want that meat." "What do you want?" asked my mother, confused. "To teach her a lesson. I want you to fire her." I watched my mother gently shake her head no. "She's getting ready to tell off Mrs. Benn," I thought. "She's going to tell her how good and kind Ruth is, how much we love her, Sharon and me." "I just can't fire Ruth," she apologized. "She's the best cook and house cleaner we've ever had." In the shoe department, my father sat alone, his lean body half hidden behind the open pages of the afternoon Memphis Press Scimitar. "I came here specially to tell you," I began, wishing that Ruth could hear all my sweetness, "about the Nazis that came into Jenkinsville on the 11:30 train." He turned from the paper.
"What about them?"
I felt like an actress who finally gets her big chance, but just at the moment the spotlights expose her, she remembers that she has neglected to learn her lines.
"Well," I said, "there was a whole bunch of them. They were about as big and mean-looking as anybody could be."
His eyes went back to the Press Scimitar.
"Well, aren't you interested in the really exciting thing that happened?"
"What happened?"
"Some people say that God strikes down a liar." "Boom," I decided to risk it.
"One of the prisoners tried to escape."
A wrinkle of genuine interest came slicing between his neat black eyebrows.
You mean after they got off the train?
Yes, sir. As soon as he stepped off the train, I noticed that his head started moving around, so right away I became suspicious. I guess the guard noticed it, too, because he came right up behind him and said, "Make one move and I'll blow your brains out." Just like that. "I'll blow your brains out."
Is that all?
Yes, sir, that's all.
Then let me read my paper in peace.
If you follow Main Street past Front Street, the road continues even though the pavement ends. I stood at the corner looking down the narrow dirt road towards Nigger Bottoms, wishing to be black for a while so that I could enter into the other Jenkinsville. By the side of the road, two women stood. Nearby, a scrawny rooster chased a large speckled hen. The bigger of the women pointed to the hysterical hen before leaning her head close to the ear of her friend. Suddenly their heads fell back, and the high notes of their laughter carried all the way up to Front Street. The thought came to me that even from a distance, people dislike being watched. I moved on down Front Street to Mr. Matthew Hawks's run-down drugstore. People say the aspirin old Maddie sells has been on the shelf so long that it gives more headaches than it could ever take away. Next to Hawks's drugstore is Cook Brothers Furniture and Appliances. Then comes a second-hand clothing store which never had a sign saying what its name is. After that is Mr. J.G. Jackson's cotton gin office and the office and printing press of Mr. Quentin Blakey's Rice County Gazette. And right next to the Gazette's office is something interesting. I mean, you wouldn't exactly think it was interesting because there's nothing there now besides a vacant building with a Coca-Cola advertisement and a sign that says the Chew Lee Grocery Company. Well, Mr. Lee, everybody called him the Chink, was the first merchant to open every morning and the very last to close. Maybe that was because of him and Mrs. Lee living in the back of the store, so convenient and all. What happened, I don't exactly understand. One day he was doing business just like always, and the next day, without so much as a going-out-of-business sale, he had taken his groceries and left. I guess it happens. People get sick or find better opportunities elsewhere. But why would there be this hole, bigger than a football, right through the plate-glass window? At first I thought maybe the moving men hadn't been careful when they were carting things out. But when I looked inside the empty store, there was all this glass lying around the floor, so the window just had to be broken from the outside. I would have forgotten all about it except for what I happened to hear Mr. J.G. Jackson say to my father.
"Our boys at Pearl Harbor would have got a lot of laughs at the farewell party we gave the Chink."
Then Mr. Jackson laughed, and my father gave a weak laugh, too, as though his heart wasn't really in it, but still he wanted to keep the respect of so important a man as Mr. J.G. Jackson. Later, when I asked my father what Mr. Jackson meant by that, he told me that I was never in my life to mention it again. All I know is that if Mr. Lee had been Japanese, then it might have made more sense. Anyway, there's probably a simple logical explanation. It couldn't be what I think. Chapter 2. It was 10 o'clock Sunday morning when my father came back from doing his bookwork at the store and asked, just as nice as you please, if we were all ready to go to Memphis. Like he didn't mind at all. My mother dearly loves to go home again, and Sharon likes playing with our little cousins, Diane and Jerry. Me? Sometimes Grandpa and I discuss the important things that are happening in the world. We both, for example, think President Roosevelt is a very great man. I talk a lot with Grandma, too, but she's always asking me questions. Am I gaining any weight? Not really. How am I doing at school? I make a lot of C's. Then she gets around to the hardest question of all. Do I have a lot of friends? I guess so. But even with the questions, Grandma and Grandpa are nice, so I've never understood exactly why my father disliked them so much. I think the problem may have started when he married my mother, and Grandpa didn't give him a job in his real estate business, S. Freed and Sons. Now, my father is always saying that he'd rather starve than have to work for Grandpa and his brothers-in-law, but I think he resented it all the same, because the company is big enough not only for Grandpa and his two sons, but for two of Grandpa's nephews, and even the outsider Bernard Kaplan, who runs the insurance end of things. Considering the trouble my father had with his own parents, it's really sad that he doesn't have in-laws he can love. Even now, he never even mentions his own mother. I don't remember Grandma Bergen as being mean, but I was only about Sharon's age when she died, so I don't know for sure. About the only sure thing I remember is her hair, which was auburn like mine. And I'm not the only one who's noticed that. Uncle Max, my father's oldest brother, says my hair, my eyes, and even my way remind him of her. Uncle Max also told me that on a poor working-class street like Hamel Street in South Memphis, the Bergens were considered the poorest of the poor. Grandma Bergen's dresses were washed so many times that the threads were almost countable. And poor Grandpa Bergen, a cobbler, died of a heart attack at 42 when he was only $7 short of saving enough for a stitching machine. With one of those machines, he was sure he could repair enough shoes to support his family. Which gets to another point. Since the Bergens were so poor, I think my father would still be a ticket seller at Union Station if it hadn't been for Grandpa and Grandma Freed's lending him the money to go into business. So wouldn't you expect him to be all choked up with gratitude? Well, he's not. Maybe it's because he hates favors, not so much to give as to take them. I don't like to be obligated, is the way he puts it. It's as though in his own heart, he believes that he could never have made it without them, and he hates having needed them. But that doesn't make a lot of sense. Lock the doors, my father ordered as he backed the car down the driveway. At the First Baptist Church corner, I touched his shoulder and pointed towards the glass-enclosed sign in the churchyard. Hey, did you see that? It says, Send Now, Pay Later. I didn't know they charged for that, did you? I started up a laugh, but when nobody joined in, it made a hollow sound. Okay, he said. Don't bother me when I'm driving. Suddenly Sharon jumped off the back seat and touched my father's shoulder at the very spot I had touched. There's a bee on you, she shouted. April Fools! From deep within his throat, my father chuckled, while Mother turned around to give Sharon a love pinch on her cheek. Are you the bad girl that fooled your daddy? She asked. Sharon reached out to touch the neck of Mother's lavender dress. There's a bee on you, April Fools! She squealed with delight. Mother pretended horror. Get that bee away! She said, swatting at the neck of her dress. After a few more of Sharon's April Fool bees, Mother seemed to tire of the game. Can't you do something? She asked me. Amuse Sharon. Tell her the story of the three little pigs. I don't know if I remember that story, I lied. But the story of Cinderella and her wicked stepmother is still fresh in my mind. At the end of the story, when Cinderella marries the world's handsomest prince at the world's fanciest wedding, Sharon sighed, looking every bit as happy as the bride and a whole lot sleepier. She curled up in the corner, and with just a touch of a smile on her lips, fell asleep. So, if we take the men's underwear to the back of the store, Mother was saying, we could use the front counter for an impulse item. Men's underwear is a big seller. We sold more than $6,000 worth last year. But, Harry, we'd sell every bit as much, she argued, because men come in specially to buy it. But with women's blouses, it's different. A woman sees something pretty, and she just ups and buys it spur of the moment.
Well, said my father, as though he didn't want to give in too quickly, don't go moving things tomorrow. We've got a lot of merchandise waiting to be checked in.
When we reached the two-lane Harahan Bridge that connects West Memphis, Arkansas, to Memphis, Tennessee, I looked down at the bluey-brown Mississippi. They say the river's current is strong and very few people have ever been able to swim across, although not a year goes by that somebody doesn't drown in the attempt. This may sound crazy, because the only time I ever go swimming is a couple of times in early summer when Edna Louise Jackson's mother takes a bunch of us to the public pool in Wind City, but I could swim it. The secret is in absolutely refusing to let the river beat you down. If I had to, I'd measure my progress in inches. One more inch I've swum, one less inch to swim. Once you know the secret, then nobody's river can bring you down. On Riverside Drive, Memphis's front door, my father dropped his speed down to between 30 and 35 miles per hour. My mother was resting her head against the seat, her eyes closed as though she were dozing. She was wearing her healthy-looking black hair in my favorite way, brushed back so that her widow's peak shone like an extra added attraction above her high forehead. And hers wasn't an everyday pretty face. The shape of the nose, the cut of the chin, but it was more than that, more than its parts. My mother's face was an artist's vision of sensitivity, intelligence, and love. And so it had to be a big lie what they say about beauty being only skin deep. For if it weren't really there, why would it show? The problem must be me. I've never been what she wanted, never done what she asked, always making my own little changes and additions. Why do I do it? Why can't I be better, more obedient, more loving? I leaned over, placing my lips against hers. Those lips suddenly tightened. And there I stood, still bending over her. Ugly, naked, and alone. She opened her eyes. I wish you wouldn't bother me when I'm trying to sleep. Sorry, I answered, letting my head fall against the window of the back seat. I've been meaning to tell you, she said after a short period of quiet. If Grandmother tries to give you money, you just tell her you don't need anything. But I do need something, I answered, wondering if she could understand. She didn't answer. She put her head back against the seat and closed her eyes again. If I were a rich grandmother with plenty of money, I said, I would enjoy giving things to my grandchildren. I touched her shoulder. Could you please tell me why it's all right for you to take things from Grandma, the mink coat, for example? Her eyes shot open. That was my birthday present. At least I had her attention. Well, then what about all that new porch furniture? That wasn't anybody's birthday present. That was an anniversary present for being married to your daddy for 14 years. That wasn't a present, I thought, more a reward. I couldn't at the moment decide which one deserved the reward. Neither. Both. The only thing I could think to say was, oh, until a few moments later I thought of something else. What if Grandma has money for Sharon? Is that okay? Sharon's little, she answered. My father followed Jackson Avenue eastward until he came to the old stone gates of Hine Park, mostly hidden now by a pair of weeping willows. Grandpa had told me of last winter's ice storm and how the elms and maples had been damaged. Only the willows remained intact. Bending, he had said, beats breaking. Hyde Park was the greenest and most elegant residential area in the whole city. It had narrow, leafy roads which wound past fine old homes set back on limey green grass. I nudged Sharon. "Hey, sleepyhead, wake up!" She looked at me reproachfully, like Cinderella being disturbed while waltzing with the prince. "Come on, we're almost there." Her expression didn't change for the better, but she did manage to lift her chin as I retied the ribbon bow at her neck. And there it was, my grandparents' house, a 12-room Victorian painted the whitest white with windows large enough to welcome in the sun, each with its green and white striped awning sloping down like a circus tent. It would have been nice growing up in that house. Before we reached the front steps, Grandpa was already at the door. He turned to shout over his shoulder, "Mama, they're here, Pearl and Harry." Grandpa has every bit as much hair today as he did in the wedding picture that sits on his bedroom bureau. Now, 40 years later, it has changed color, and so has his expression. Then it was resolute. Yes, resolute. And now it's just gentle. His freshly shaved face carried the aroma of Old Spice. "My oldest grandchild, already a young lady," he said, hugging and kissing me. From the kitchen, the warm, sweet smell of cooking, of roast turkey and carrot simis.
"How are you, boss man?"
my father asked without shaking hands.
"Tell me when you poor folks here in Hyde Park are going to be able to afford some sidewalks."
It was his favorite joke. Grandpa said,
"Soon as my rich son-in-law lends me the money," which happened to be his favorite answer.
Grandma came from the kitchen, wiping her hands on her flowery apron. Through the years, Grandma has put on weight, and now her face, while not exactly a perfect circle, is all the same quite round. Last time we were visiting, Grandpa said that he married a 90-pound girl, and now he's got a 180-pound woman. Twice what he bargained for. That was about the only time I ever saw her mad. She insisted that she didn't weigh an ounce over 165. Grandma hugged and kissed us all, with the exception of my father, who hurriedly brushed past her on his way to the big chair with the matching ottoman. Then she started worrying whether or not we were hungry. Uncle Ben and Uncle Irv weren't coming for another hour and a half, about 2 o'clock.
"Pearl, wouldn't you like a nice bowl of soup now? Maybe Harry and the children would like a little something to hold them."
"Oh, Mother, I hope you didn't cook one of your big starchy dinners. You know I have to watch my weight."
"Watch your weight at your own house. Here, when my children and grandchildren come to visit, I cook."
Mother agreed to a cup of coffee, and my father, after finding out that it was chicken soup with matzo balls, his favorite, relented.
"I saw your brother Max," Grandpa said to my father. "He doesn't go to many of the brotherhood meetings. He's a nice fellow, your brother."
"Good as gold," my father agreed. "And if you ever want the world to know something, just tell him. Worst blabbermouth in town."
Grandpa let his lips pout forward as if the thought were new and surprising.
"I should worry about that. I'm too old for women. I pay my bills. I never hurt anybody. People with dark secrets should worry about Max. Me, I'm not going to worry."
Actually, Uncle Max wasn't really so much of a blabbermouth as he was a rememberer. There wasn't much that he forgot about people, especially about his family. I think that's why my father always seems funny, a little tense around him. Maybe he enjoys remembering what my father enjoys forgetting. Like the time last Yom Kippur, when we were all standing around outside the Beth Zion Synagogue, and one of Uncle Max's remembrances made my father so angry that he called him a damn liar right to his face. He was telling what a hot temper my father had had when he was a boy, how he sometimes became uncontrollably mad at one of his brothers, usually Arnie. More than once, according to Uncle Max, Grandfather Bergen had to sit on his son's bed late at night, repeating, "You will not be violent. You will not be violent." Grandpa sat down next to me on the gold brocade sofa.
"You've been writing any more letters to the editor of the Commercial Appeal?"
he asked, patting my arm. "Oh, no, sir, not any more. I only wrote that one because of that stupid man who wrote that the war was all President Roosevelt's fault."
"Such an intelligent letter," said Grandpa, adjusting his eyeglasses. "Most people twice your age wouldn't have written so well."
I turned my head to see what my father thought of that. But he was too deep into Look magazine's story about a soldier's farewell to hear. And my mother was only interested in her fingernails, which she was filing with a well-used emery board. For a moment, I thought I might come right out and ask her if she had liked my letter, too, but I didn't. I didn't want to give her the impression that her opinion was all that important to me. The dining room table was set for 14 with a fine damask cloth, sterling silver flatware, and real crystal glasses, two for each setting. Grandma always served Mogan David, and I couldn't remember a time when I was too young for my own wine glass. I could always tell how grown up Grandma considered me by how much wine she poured. When I was Sharon's age, only the bottom of the glass was covered, but when I was 10, it was at the halfway mark. Last Hanukkah, and I'm not exaggerating, it was 3/4. At our house, we have damask cloths, crystal and sterling, too, but I can't remember my mother ever using them. Anyway, I know she's never cooked a dinner like Grandma. Now, Ruth is a very good cook, too, but it's not the same. It's still like eating somebody else's food, while Grandma's is like finally coming home. On the gas stove were two restaurant-sized pots, one filled with simmering golden soup, and the other had kasha with noodle bows. Grandma opened the door of the oven, slid out the rack, and basted the turkey with a large metal spoon. She wiped her hands on a kitchen towel before looking me over.
"My grandchildren are growing up," she said, sighing. "And when do I see you? Why don't you like visiting your grandmother?"
"But I do."
"I ask your mother why she never brings you on the train with her. She says you're too busy with all your friends."
"My mother told you that?" I asked, not believing.
"Your mother always tells me that," she answered.
"Well, she's telling a lie." Grandma looked at me, and then she nodded her head as if she knew just what to do about it.
"Listen, next week we'll plan a day. You take the 8 o'clock morning train, and we'll spend the whole day together. I'll buy you clothes, anything you want. We'll have lunch together. You like the top of the Hotel Peabody, the Skyway?"
"I just love it," I said. "I've never been there, but sometimes I listen to WREC. They broadcast the dinner music right from the Skyway. I've always wanted to go there. Will Mother go, too?"
"Well," said Grandma, thinking it over.
Suddenly she shook her head no.
"Let her stay home. She'll only tell me you don't need a thing, and somehow we'll end up shopping for her."
"I can't wait," I said, feeling as though she had slipped into my team's colors. Backtracking, I tried to remember exactly what it was Grandma had said about buying me anything I wanted. Did that mean only clothes?
"Is there something wrong?"
"Oh, no, ma'am," I said, knowing it was those two vertical think lines that sometimes invite themselves to my forehead that prompted her question. It's just that I was wondering if... I mean, if I don't buy but one dress, and if it's not too expensive, do you think it might be all right if I bought a book?